The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
There's a lot of phraseology that is bandied about these days, whether we're talking about discrimination or racism or phobias of one sort or another. Added to this list, one that's not talked about much, but quite frankly, the reverberation of its impact is being felt more and more, especially in countries that heretofore have been locations where faith, particularly of the Christian sort, had been celebrated. My guest tonight is a sociologist. In fact, he's professor of sociology at the University of North Texas. He's the author of a number of best-selling books and serves as founder of Reconciliation Consulting, helping churches and ministries develop and sustain a multiracial emphasis. His latest book is called Hostile Environment, Understanding and Responding to Anti-Christian Bias. And George Yancey, great to have you on the program tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
Doctor, let's talk first a bit about the phraseology here, the term that that you're using throughout the book, Christianophobia. Help us understand exactly what that is. And you know, as we think of phobias in general, they're anxiety disorders. One definition tells us that they are a persistent fear disproportionate to the actual danger posed. As you use the term, give us some definitions.
Yeah, and I, my co-author of a previous book, really struggled with this. What do we call what we're seeing? What do we call what we're documenting? And, you know, I can't say that I'm completely satisfied with Christianophobia, but it's probably the best of bad choices. When we use phobias, the way we're using it in today's society, it's not just about fear. It's about anger. It's about bigotry, if you will, towards a certain group. That's Islamophobia, homophobia, so forth and so on. And what we've documented fits into that category. For example, many of the people that we got information from that answered our questionnaire talked about Christians taking over instead of a theocracy and forcing everyone to become Christians, which we thought was nonsense, but these were well-educated people who had this sort of fear, an unfounded fear, an unfounded anger. And so we settled on Christianophobia. Is it perfect? No, but until I can find a better term, that's one I'll use.
Okay. With that said, why not, I don't know, we hear of anti-Semitism. How about anti-Christian? Why specifically Christianophobia?
I actually thought about anti-Christian as a possibility, and it has some merit. One of the problems with using that term, I felt, was, are you anti-Christian because of a fear, or do you just not believe in Christianity, and therefore, you know, I don't agree with Christians. I'm anti-Christian philosophy or theocracy or theology or things of that nature. And so it probably was my second choice, but I don't feel it's quite as good as Christianophobia.
As we talk about it, let's perhaps get into some of the arenas where we're seeing this begin to appear. I mean, to the degree to which it is an attitude against people of faith, specifically Christians, that we've seen demonstrated in many parts of the world. We can certainly travel to many parts of the Middle East. We can travel to Islamic countries where not only is the Christianophobia quite prevalent at many layers, it is not only accepted socially, but even institutionally, meaning it's endorsed by governments, it's endorsed by the state church, in this case, Islam. But what about here in America? We're beginning to see incidents of this, and while perhaps not reported on with any frequency on the 6 o'clock news, we're beginning to see increased incidences of this in academia, in politics, the government. Some of it seems to be kind of casual and covert, others more overt and even systematic. Why this trend, particularly in a country like the United States, whose very foundation was founded on the principles that ran contrarian to this notion of again, the anti-Christian bias or Christianophobia?
Well, you know, at one point, the United States was a society where, if not a Christian nation, was dominated by a Christian culture. And to be against that culture was to put you on the outside. And so Christians had the dominant control in society, for good or for bad. I mean, sometimes Christians misused it, but they still had this control. What's happened is that we're becoming a more multicultural society, where Christianity is no longer the dominant religion, and where other groups now have gained a lot of power. And so, whether this has happened, you know, it's happened somewhat slowly, but we see accelerating at this point. Groups have gained power who never had power before, and the resentment that they had against Christians, they can now act out on them. Now, I would say that this is not the, obviously this is not the same thing as the Middle East. And these groups, the people with Christianophobia, like to pride themselves on being religiously neutral, on not being bigots themselves. And so they do something that has been noted in race literature, which I know now, which is they try to find an issue where they can justify it on non-bigoted grounds, and yet it still has a negative impact on Christians.
So this notion, Doctor, that intolerance is never accepted, but there are certain cases where the so-called tolerant are happy to be intolerant, provided that it's only directed toward certain groups.
Well, they like to say they're intolerant of the intolerant, which, you know, doesn't make sense if you really think it through. But yeah, there clearly is an intolerance, and in their social identity, they see themselves as well-educated, as tolerant. So it's very hard for to point out how intolerant they are, because in their mind they can't be intolerant because they are progressive, educated, whatever adjective you want to use. Even though clearly we see that in Christianophobia.
Are there those who are perhaps dismissive of the impact of Christianophobia because it is different than many of the other types of phobias that are out there? And by that, I mean this, Doctor. Racism, I mean, clearly an individual, they're born of what they're born of. There's their birthright. It's their racial makeup. Don't get much of a choice in that. Some might argue that even homophobia, based on behavior. But Christianophobia is an attack or an assault on an individual, a sense of bias against that person based solely on what they believe, which kind of makes it unique in that case, doesn't it?
Well, there's anti-Semitism and there's Islamophobia, which you could say is the same thing. So I don't know if it's unique in that sense. It may be more unique in the United States because you have a group that's been a dominant group that now is becoming a minority group, and people are finding ways to attack them now that they don't have the power they once had.
We're going to take a time out on that point, come back to more of our conversation today with Dr. George Yancey. He is professor of sociology at the University of North Texas. His new book is called Hostile Environment, Understanding and Responding to Anti-Christian Bias. A brief time out, back to more of our conversation as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Our conversation with Dr. George Yancey, professor of sociology at the University of North Texas. The new book is called Hostile Environment, Understanding and Responding to Anti-Christian Bias. Why do we see this growing sense of bias in the country today, Doctor? What's the best way to phrase this? Inconsistently applied. And by that, I mean, for example, if you have conversations with some people that demonstrate a clear Christianophobia, they may not necessarily take objection to, I don't know, say a mainline denominational Methodist who opens a soup kitchen, and yet they will rear their hackles when you talk about an evangelical running for political office, for example. Why does it seem to be inappropriately or not consistently applied?
Well, I think that those with Christianophobia, they have a certain set of values and actions that they deem acceptable and those that they deem unacceptable. And as long as Christians do that which is acceptable, then they don't face any of these pressures. It's when Christians vary from that which they see as unacceptable. And, of course, some of the values I think most Christians will be comfortable with, but others, especially more conservative Christians, are not very comfortable with and are not willing to compromise their values. And that's where the conflict arises. So, you know, it's like anything else. I mean, if you do what I agree, you know, should be right, then I don't have a problem with you. Tolerance only comes into play when you start doing things I disagree with. And then we talk about tolerance.
There's certainly a degree, I think, in any culture, any society that has differing people groups coming together, whether you're of different backgrounds, different cultures, different languages, different religions, there can be degrees at which we don't always mix together that well. We don't completely understand the way each other thinks or functions, and so therefore the things that we don't understand, we tend to kind of create this bias towards. So to the degree to which in this so-called melting pot experiment of America, that there's been sort of this underlying pool of discrimination kind of lying low below the surface, is probably arguably there. That said, we've seen an increase, particularly in relationship to attitudes towards Christians in our country. Some might say to the point where it's becoming overt and systematic. Why do we see? Is there anything to which in your studies points to the reasons why this rise in Christianophobia?
You know, I would just say it's just a matter of, you know, that the sentiment has been there, but people didn't have the power to do anything about it, and now they have the power to do something about it. So, you know, perhaps in the past, people wanted to have some of these rules that would disproportionately hurt Christians, but if they tried to pass those sort of rules, they would have been slapped down. But now you can pass those sort of rules. And so the way I would see it is it's a matter of power. That certain groups now have power to harm Christians, and they don't like Christians for a variety of different reasons, and now so they are going to use that power.
What about those that would argue that for there to be any demonstration of true bias or discrimination, that you must show a loss of position or opportunity or favor tied directly to one's identity? And that some would argue, well, wait a minute, though. Most Christians in America tend to live a privileged life. They really haven't suffered discrimination when it comes to opportunities and employment and education and things of this sort. So where's the discrimination? Where's the bias?
Okay, you know, that's a very interesting question. And having been someone studying race and ethnicity, a lot of times people would ask, you know, well, we talk about blacks. I don't see a lot of overt racism towards blacks today. So where's the problem? And so part of it is, you know, we aren't going to see overt, you're a Christian, therefore I'm not going to do this, and what have you. I mean, it doesn't work that way in today's society because no one wants to be seen as biased. Having said all that, I did research several years ago when I sent a questionnaire out to academics, and I asked them, if you knew that this person was belonged to this group, would you more or less likely to hire them? And the two groups that academics were less likely to hire, they found out a person belonged to, was fundamentalists and evangelicals. With fundamentalists, about 45 to 50% of all academics that I surveyed said that they would be less likely to hire them. Evangelicals, a little bit less, about 40 to 35%. I don't have the precise numbers in my head. So there, now you have a situation where, while that evangelical fundamentalist may not know it, he or she may have lost a job because someone did not want to hire them because of their religious beliefs. I have anecdotes, but that is systematic evidence of anti-Christian bias and what that anti-Christian bias can mean in our society.
All right, toward that end, it begs the question, and this is going to make some people feel uncomfortable, but I think we need to ask this question, particularly since you delineate a stronger degree of anti-Christian bias or Christianophobia towards conservatives or evangelicals. Is there a degree to which we have contributed to some of this rise in bias? And I ask that question, let's use an example that everybody's familiar with, Westboro Baptist Church, and I hesitate to even refer to it as a church. We know from a traditional conservative evangelical Bible-based viewpoint that much of what they do is abhorrent. And yet they pull on the moniker of, we do this in the name of Christ, we do this in the name of God. They claim to be evangelical Christians, and so therefore there is this label now that's associated. And I have to wonder, while this might be an extreme example, does any of the research, particularly as you talk to people that find an increase in their sense of negativity towards Christians, again, Christianophobia, that some of this, quite frankly, some of the culpability may fall on our own shoulders?
Well, you know, I don't think you have to go as far as Westboro Baptist. Even when we become Christians, we don't become perfect, and so we do sin, and we sin against other people. You know, having to say race, there are sins Christians have done historically concerning racism. and we can look at other problems. So Christians are not innocent in that they've been perfect and now people are coming and attacking them. However, no group deserves all the prejudice that they tend to receive. And so while, yes, Christians are not perfect, Christians have done some things, we've victimized some people, the level of fear and hatred that I document in my research and that I talk about in this book does not match the problems that Christians have created. And so I talk about both in the book. I talk about how Christians have created some of their own problems, but that does not justify, for example, the discrimination that I just documented, I told you about when it comes to academia. So it's sort of a both and approach. Yes, we need to get our act together as Christians, but we also deserve not to shut out the public square, which I think is the goal of people with Christianophobia, not to put Christians in jail, of course, but to silence them so that they no longer have a voice in the public square.
We understand that, you know, part of this is based on stereotypes, as you're suggesting, the notion that Christians, evangelicals, are intolerant, bigoted, backward, hypocritical, self-righteous. I mean, on and on, the list of adjectives goes. And yet I have to wonder, what can we, if we can't control their actions, what can we do to at least stem the tide or change some of the impressions that are out there that, as you point out, while perhaps the Westboro Baptist Church is on the extreme side of the continuum, but nevertheless, there is a sense, I think, perhaps, that to a degree to which we kind of are contributory to all of this. And we know from a purely biblical perspective, yes, we're going to be hated and despised for his namesake. That said, are there things that we can and should be doing, particularly in a pluralistic society like the United States, that would help to stem the tide of Christianophobia?
Well, in my book, I go into more detail on this, but in a nutshell, here's kind of how I see it. We're not going to be the most powerful religious group for some point in time, for who knows how long. But we still have a right to have a voice in the public square. So I believe we have to fight for that voice in the public square. On the other hand, we're going to have to perhaps overcome some of our differences to sort of unite, to work together, so that we can protect each other. We're going to have to go into some of the cultural areas, art, entertainment, academia, where we've not been, in order to influence in that way. I think it's a long-term project to accept the fact that we're not going to be the dominant group, but we have a voice, and we can grow as a group if we are careful. If we can penetrate some of the cultural institutions, if we can keep our own communities and keep our own values. It's going to be a long, hard project, but, you know, with the grace of God, it's doable.
And as you mentioned, we've just kind of skim the surface of this very deep topic. You can go deeper inside the pages of this new book, Hostile Environment, Understanding and Responding to Anti-Christian Bias. The book, by the way, published by InterVarsity Books, available at bookstores throughout the Bay Area through many of the usual suspects and Amazon.com and George Yancey's website, simply George Yancey, Yancey, GeorgeYancey.com. And Professor Yancey, thanks so much for the time and the insight. Hostile Environment, Understanding and Responding to Anti-Christian Bias.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
We think often of what it means, the significance of the spiritual heritage that many of us have, those that have a connection to the history of the church and faith through the faith of our fathers. And as much as we oftentimes ponder what that means, how often do we stop and think about the faith of not just our fathers, but the faith of our sons? The reality is that as much as the gospel message is timeless, we're seeing the way current generations react to it, and most notably how oftentimes we're beginning to see a shift taking place, that while the faith of our fathers and that generation and maybe the current generation is strong, the faith of our sons and our daughters is on weak grounds. There is some new research out by the respected pollster George Barna. In fact, he's been a guest on this program many times, that would suggest that there is a frightening trend taking place amongst 20-somethings in our country today. And to get some insights on this topic, David Kinneman joins us. He has written a new book entitled You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith. He serves also as the president of the Barna Group. And David, great to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
You know, we always want to hear about the enthusiasm of young people and their relationship with Jesus Christ. I know that fondly, there's a good percentage of those listening to our conversation right now who found Christ as young children or as teenagers and have continued on in faith for years and years and years. And yet to begin to see that there is a trend taking place that isn't a very encouraging one, I think ought to cause all of us to pause and ask the question, what's happening? If we understand that the gospel is timeless, then what of Christianity today in the West, in North America, that suddenly is not maintaining the same appeal, so to speak, for those in that special age group of late teens into their 20s?
Well, what's challenging for us now is that the culture has changed so quickly over the last 10, 20 years that we make the argument in the research that essentially people are more enculturated than ever. They're more captive to our culture than we've ever seen a generation done so. And this is true of young Christians. This is true of young non-Christians. They have more access to all sorts of ideas and worldviews through technology. They have, you know, exposure to, sexuality and all sorts of things earlier in life. Media is giving them a certain sort of worldview and perspective. And so for those reasons and many others, a lot of social changes. They're getting married much later. They're having children much later. They're responding to the divorce culture that the boomers largely, you know, enacted in our culture. And so for many reasons, they're disengaging from the church. They're disengaging from Christianity in some cases. And we do need to pay attention to this cultural reality and how is it that we actually raise young people of deep faith.
Is this then less about perhaps a particular age group then on the continuum, David, as it is suggestive of the church losing some of its grasp, some of its influence then on culture?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting you asked me that, because when you talk about this phrase, "you lost me," we very intentionally titled it because that's the voice of the next generation about the church. You know, "you lost me, I don't get it, I don't understand." And part of it's because they're so distracted, they're so busy doing other things. But I think you're actually really on point with that question, in that what we're finding from a lot of our research is it's certainly true of the next generation and how we work with them, but it's also true of all of us in this culture, of any generation, that we're more distracted, our attention spans are shorter, we have more, there's more things that are vying for our, you know, time and attention and mind space. And so I think it's more difficult for the gospel to go forward in this, you know, very abundant, pluralist, very rich country that we have. And no nation has ever been able to really withstand the prosperity that America currently enjoys. I think that's the kind of question we need to ask ourselves, is how do we disciple in that era, not just the next generation, but all of us.
Well, and I think not just the appeal, as you're suggesting, of all that the culture, so to speak, has to offer in every sense of the word. But then, too, it strikes me, David, that relationships have changed pretty significantly. I mean, for example, having grown up as a product of the 1960s and 70s, having come to faith in Christ in the 1970s, it didn't take a lot of explaining to do when we talked about what it meant to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, to walk in fellowship with very God himself. I mean, we were all in that era longing for a deeper, more significant, more satisfying relationship on the human level. So that meant something to us, and those were words and phrases that resonated with the longing that we were seeking to satisfy. That said, look at the way things have changed for this generation that has grown up on cable television and the internet and texting, and you know, relationships today are about what you do on the backside of an iPhone, as opposed to the level of contact, that the just pure human contact that we used to have has changed so radically. And so I would wonder if part of this is just the notion of how we do relationships has changed so much. If I can't relate to a personal one-on-one conversation with my dad because I'm used to doing all this stuff electronically, how can I possibly think about a personal one-on-one relationship with a God that I can't even see?
That's really well said. And when you think about it, so when you talk about a youth group or a college ministry, and in the past, 20 years ago, that provided a sort of extracurricular place for a person to have a relationship, not only with God, but also with each other, with other Christians. And what we're seeing with the youngest generation of teenagers now, young Christians, is that the youth group experience is even changing in that they don't need the social network of the youth group like they did in the past. It's really more about either their pursuit of God or their pursuit of other kinds of things. We're finding that their engagement in youth ministry is changing. And I think this goes to the heart of it that, you know, what we found in this research is that it's not enough for us just to have young people who are engaged in church services and really as parents or youth pastors or as any kind of leader within a church. We need to do a better job of recognizing that the signs of faithfulness aren't just attendance at a program, that in fact, as we're living in an information world, I think that Jesus is getting lost in the data stream of all the tweeting and Facebooking and digital activities that we have. And just as you say, it's hard enough to have face-to-face relationships with others. I think this idea of connecting with a real and holy and personal God is actually really changing for this generation, and unfortunately most churches and parents say, well, you know, my young person is there, they're attending faithfully, and that's not, in my mind, enough of a measure based on all this research of faithfulness.
It's part of the problem too, as we suggested here, David, that the way we do relationships certainly in the West today is changing pretty drastically. It's easy for people to hide behind the facade of Facebook and MySpace and so-called social media, where you can kind of you can be as vulnerable or not as you choose to be. You can be as real or not as you choose to be. And when suddenly you're now trying to confront young people with a real, vibrant, true, pure, all of the bells and whistles and sort of a facade all stripped down, personal relationship with God, I would wonder if we couch it in the terms that we did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, if that doesn't scare a lot of young people today, because they look at that, I don't want that. I don't want anybody to know me that real or that intimately or that personally. I would rather hide behind the facade of who I want you to think I am, because I'm too afraid to show you who I am.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we learned from our research that a lot of these young people feel as though they have to live split lives, split personalities between their church self, their digital self, their family self, their school self. And so this era of, you know, helping, and this is an opportunity for families and churches and all of us who care about this next generation to help reconnect the soul and the person and the heart, mind, soul, and strength that Jesus talks about. And so I think there's a great opportunity for churches, but this idea of split souls, you think about that even in terms of sexuality. We see this from the research that many young people feel split. They have to be one person in church, traditionalist and buttoned up and, you know, careful about what they say, and then something else entirely when it comes to their sexual, you know, habits and lives. And so we have to do a lot of work. I mean, there's a lot of things we should be concerned about with this generation, and I think there's a lot of things we ought to be concerned about how we as the church respond in a healthy way to the culture and how we prepare students to live in that culture.
Indeed so. And the other thing, too, is, you know, oftentimes not only is there this sense of a split, as you suggest, but then I think a lot of young people feel as if they're being forced to choose one or the other. It's like the faith of my fathers or whatever option B is. And we'll talk more about this aspect. We continue our conversation tonight with David Kinnaman. He is the president of the Barna Group, a new book out that is an eye-opener. It's called You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith, as this edition of Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Back to our conversation with David Kinnaman. David is the president of the Barna Group, Barna Research. You're very familiar with the work of George Barna. They have taken time to study, in particular, the faith of our sons and daughters, and to see in what direction all of that is headed. And all of this revealed inside the pages of a new book, by the way, entitled You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church. David, as you indicated, we were talking a bit before the break, what's really happening here is that as the church is losing its influence on culture today, and as the stranglehold of the power that said culture has on young people today is ever increasing. I mean, it's clear to see how this is being set up as kind of a perfect storm, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think it's this whole research project. I mean, I'm interested in it as a researcher. I'm also interested in it as a parent. I'm interested as a pastor's son who grew up in the church. research, and it's really, for me, helped me understand how do we actually work with this generation in the midst of a changing culture. And, you know, the title is strong because that's what young people say about the church, but it's really a very hopeful project about how do we actually reconnect with this generation? How do we actually learn faithfulness in a new context? We use the story of Daniel, you know, from Scripture, where, you know, he was taken out of a comfortable social setting, you know, as a young Hebrew and taken into this culture of Babylon. We learn about that in the book of Daniel in Scripture. And we use that story really often in the book as a way of understanding what does it mean to be faithful in an entirely new context. And I think that's what we're facing now with this generation of young Christians.
All right, let me give you an example. This is right out of the front pages here. In fact, a story that appeared on ESPN regarding Tim Tebow. Everybody knows that he's been taking some flack, most specifically recently, former Broncos quarterback Jake Plummer, in a radio interview that basically said that he wished that Tebow would curb, quote, his references to Jesus and his faith, saying effectively, we're getting the message. You don't have to continue to remind me time and time again. Through the lens of this research, talk to me about that scenario.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is there's both a trend of, you know, young people losing their faith, and there's also what we call a counter trend that we describe in the book of young people who stick with faith and why. And you know, I think Tim Tebow is an example of a young 20-something who is very out front with his faith, who certainly has never, you know, lost his faith such that we know or, you know, that we can document at this point. But when you look at the culture, what is so interesting about what's challenging for young Christians is that their peers are more skeptical of ever than Christianity, and many of these peers actually had backgrounds within either Catholicism or Protestant Christianity. And so I think that's a great example of, you know, here's an example of the counter trend in Tim Tebow and the public nature of his faith. We see many other people who are in Hollywood, who are in music, who are in business, who, you know, are very much passionate about the church and about Christianity. But what's different that we see now compared to the previous generation and generations, say, of the 1960s and 50s, is that there's a bigger gap now between young Christians and their peers, and they're having to reach further in order to explain the nature of Christianity. And you know, the one thing we might say is that as much as we should support and applaud Tim Tebow's public upfront faith, you know, what is it about that that's going to transform culture? You know, it's not just because he acknowledges Jesus that he's going to be transformational. It's because of the quality of his life and other aspects of his vocation and calling that people will respond to that message. So it's important for us to recognize the skepticism of this generation as well.
Is there any attraction to this generation that looks at something like that and says, you are repeatedly subjecting yourself to criticism by doing this? And we've all seen him kneel and pray after a touchdown or during key moments during the game. It's very attention getting. He's being ridiculed for it. Does it work into the logic of this generation as we're trying to understand them better, David, that some people would say, you know, if you're willing to voluntarily subject yourself repeatedly to that kind of criticism for your faith, that there must be something awfully special about your faith? I mean, do young people draw that conclusion?
Yeah, they do, and they're looking for things that matter in the world and to their own lives and to their own sense of meaning and their own spiritual journeys. And, you know, this is where I think this is a generation that's very interested in truth and very interested in things that matter. They're also highly narcissistic and distracted, so it's sometimes difficult for us to get their attention on things. But I think they respond to seeing people that are sold out to any cause. I think the difference that we should keep in mind, too, is that they're a very diverse generation. They have come to expect that they should respect and, you know, give anybody of any faith, of any sexual persuasion, of any ethnic background, I mean, of any background at all, that, it, you know, they fully expect that everyone is equally, you know, right and equally valid at all times. And so there's a certain sense in which not many of these young people that we interview are willing to take huge risks for their own, you know, their own positioning, their own brand in the world. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, is a challenge for them. They're not necessarily willing, like Daniel in the story of the Lion's Den, necessarily willing to, you know, give up their life on behalf of their faith. And that's an interesting challenge that I think we face with this generation.
We also have a generation, I think, David, that is very interested in sort of leaving their mark on things. I mean, we're seeing this, I think, to a degree with some of, not all by a long shot, but some of the Occupy Wall Street protesters. Or we think of people that get involved in things like, you know, protecting the planet and animals and things of this sort. It seems to be a generation that very much is engaged in wanting to make a difference. Do we couch some of the impact of Christianity in those terms, so that there is that sense of attractiveness to it, or to young people by it, rather?
Well, I think you're right that there's a real sense of wanting to make a difference in the world, and they're very much socially conscious. But what we find in our research is some of that is only skin deep for these young people. You know, they it's really cool to care. In some ways, we could say that we've effectively made them consumers of causes rather than what I think Christ calls us to, is to be really spent on behalf of those causes.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. Over the weekend here, I saw some pictures of Matt Damon, who is apparently filming a new movie down in Mexico, and he's been very much in favor of PETA and urging people, you know, if you can be a vegan, you know, more power to you, and very much on that side of, you know, protecting animals, et cetera, et cetera. And here he's captured attending a bullfight in Mexico City, and I wonder what his PETA friends would say if they saw that.
Yeah, there's all these inconsistencies that, you know, we inevitably come to, and I think this is the message of one of the things that Jesus talks about in his ministry, is the fact that there's so many inconsistencies in our efforts as human beings that it's impossible for us through our own, you know, try harder-ism to just simply work harder at saving the planet or work harder at addressing these causes. And I think my challenge to us as Christians would be in understanding this next generation, that we don't want to just get them involved in a cause to change the world, because it turns out, as we learn from the gospel and from the Bible, that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and in fact, you know, we need to have a healthy reverence for the Lord's work, that we should care about these issues, but we can't solve them in our own human effort and power. And yet at the same time, if our faith is simply about, you know, believe these things in order to get to heaven one day and convince everyone else to get to heaven because of your faith in Christ, if it is simply and only about event, you know, sort of getting people saved and salvation, I think it also does this generation a disservice, that they really are called and interested in understanding how their faith gets worked out in the world. And so we owe them, I think, that the depth that following Christ, that following the gospel means we're concerned about eternity, but we're also concerned about how we live our lives and the quality of how, the kind of impact we have on our neighbors and on our workplaces and on our families.
We're talking about a new book, You Lost Me, and, you know, this really ought to sit on the shelf, better put on the desk, of every youth minister, youth pastor, every senior pastor, everyone who's engaged in organizations like YWAM, Youth with a Mission, Youth for Christ, and so many others, as we gain a better understanding through the research of the Barna Group, the attitudes of where young people are today, and most importantly, what we can do to get a better job at engaging the culture, capturing the culture for the cause of Christ, and as a result, not just reaching young people for Jesus, but keeping them for Jesus. Toward that end, David Kinnaman, author of this new book, are there some of the trends that we're seeing, too, that some people feel as if, young people feel as if they have to make a choice, that it's either between kind of launching out on my own identity or embracing mom and dad's religion, or even in some cases with debates over everything going on concerning science and bioethics and technology, even sometimes young people feeling as if they have to choose between belief in God or science?
Yeah, I think throughout this book and throughout the research that underlies it, we saw this choice that young people felt they had to make between their friends and their faith, between being a young scientist or someone in medicine and their faith, between choosing to doubt or being comfortable with the doubts that they have and being faithful. So many different places where young people feel that they have to choose between being the Christian they're called to be or being the person who they are. And you know, that's a challenge. I think, again, throughout Scripture, you see this tension where we have to live, you know, in the world but not of the world. This is something that Jesus prays for his followers in John 17, the in but not of tension. And I think that's the tension that every generation has faced. I think it's more pressing than ever now with this generation. And throughout the project, again, we talk about the reasons for disconnection, but we also talk about the reasons for reconnection. So, for instance, when we talk about having to choose between our faith and our friends, we make the argument that really the church has done an inadequate job of talking not just about the singular salvation through available through Christ, but how Jesus himself had this heart for outsiders and really wanted to pursue people around him. You know, he was notorious for hanging out with sinners. He had a heart for people that were lost. And I think this generation feels as though the church experiences and their parents and the sort of the nice, comfortable Christian way of life pushes them to choose a way of life where they have to choose the safe, comfortable religious life or exclude their friends. And really, I think it's a false choice. And in so many of these cases, we learn that the choice between science and faith, between friends and faith, they're false choices that we need to reframe for young people.
For everyone who has a heart for young people listening right now, whether they're engaged in full-time ministry or just love the Lord, love young people, what would you say is the most significant message underlying You Lost Me that you want readers to take away from that can kind of be an action item for the church?
Well, I care about this generation enormously. I love the church. I want to see them together. And what we learned is that in so many cases, the friendships, the relationships that we think we have with this generation, they're not as deep as we imagine them to be. And I was also shocked to find how often these young people had no idea how their faith really intersects their vocation or their calling or what God calls them to do. I mean, as an expression, only 16% of young Christians said they knew how the Bible applied to their field or interest area or profession. And we need to do a better job. I mean, we owe this next generation so much more to prepare them to live in but not of this culture. And I think the research really gives you some tools, not only to understand the disconnections, but really to understand how do we reconnect? How do we learn from this generation and serve them as God pursues them and their heart and their potential service in the future for the kingdom?
Some insights inside the pages of You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith. Nobly published by Baker Books, available at bookstores throughout the Bay Area. You can also get information on the web. David Kinnaman, that's K-I-N-N-A-M-A-N, davidkinnaman.com. David, thanks so much for the time and the insights. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Lifeline. Thanks so much for being with us. And if there was anything you heard on today's show that you'd like to hear again or share with a friend, grab a copy of the Lifeline podcast. Simply log on to KFAX.com. That's KFAX.com for the Lifeline podcast. Our producer is Wanda Sanchez. I'm Craig Roberts. Till next time round, remember, just don't keep the faith. Get out there and share it and make it a great evening. So long.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of KFAX. Copyright Salem Communications, all rights reserved.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.